Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. When Russia invaded Ukraine, it was already under sanctions that were imposed after its actions in Crimea in 2014. Now, those sanctions targeted banks, but did the way in which they were imposed and introduced allow many Russian banks and their customers to escape the worst effects? In the first of two detective stories this week, Mikhail Mamonov of the Toulouse Business School talked to me about a very personal piece of research into how Russian banks have minimized the impact of financial sanctions. So Mikhail, hello again.
Hello, Tim.
Mikhail, our story today, this all dates back 10 years now to 2014. Remind us, what was the event that kicked all this off?
Oh, unfortunately, yeah, we have to. Early 2014, the Russian government decided to annex Crimean Peninsula, effectively entering the territory of the neighboring country. The West responded immediately by introducing first packages of sanctions. These were broad sanctions against firms, individuals, and banks. I would say in the 2010s, we had these mild sanctions, roughly 31 sanctions announcements by the US Office of Foreign Asset Control against firms and banks. And in 2022, clearly after the full-scale war started, we've been observing how many, maybe 13 or 14 packages of much more severe sanctions. And it seems there is no light in the end of the tunnel, unfortunately.
These sanctions from 2014, how serious were they? Were they intended as a slap on the wrist, or were they really intended to change Russia's behavior?
I don't think so, that they were intended to change Russia's behavior. They were just intended to show that if you do something wrong in terms of geopolitics, then we want to reduce economic exposure to you in terms of trade and finance. And people were calling those sanctions in the 2010s smart sanctions. They were not targeting the whole population or the whole economy. They were targeting only state-connected firms and banks. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, they were mild, without any consequences for international operations of those banks and firms with, let's say, neutral countries, only with the West and only with a specifically defined category of firms and banks.
And what specifically about these sanctions, apart from the obvious, interested you?
In our research with Steven Ongena from the University of Zurich and Anna Pestova, also from Toulouse Business School, we've been focused on the effects of those globally coordinating sanction policy in the 2010s on state-connected banks and firms borrowing from those banks. We've been discussing why those sanctions didn't reach their goal. We are trying to understand why this happened. First of all, the sanction policy in the 2010s has been implemented in a staggered fashion, meaning that not all state-connected banks and firms from the list, they were sanctioned all at once so that, you know, to maximize this effect of the first announcement when nobody expected anything, nobody knows how to react. Quite oppositely, the sanctions were phased in and roughly 44 state-connected banks were sanctioned in a five-year period of time instead of being sanctioned all at once. So the first important thing to understand is that when you have this staggered implementation, it's very naive to expect that all those state-connected banks and firms, they will not adjust their international operations having observed the first sanction announcement. We show that the first bank sanctioned by OFAC, the nickname is Putin's wallet, the so-called Bank Rossiya, controlled by one of the richest oligarch family in Russia. It was sanctioned in something like March 17, 2014. The next day, Putin appeared in the branch of this bank and opened an account in front of TV cameras that are signaling that nothing will happen to this bank. At the same time, OFAC designed these two sets of sanctions. First one is called sectorial sanctions. if you fall under these sectorial sanctions, you cannot place new debts in Western financial markets. Mm-hmm. This was applied to banks and firms that had no operations in Crimea or other annexed territories. The second type of sanctions is called specially designated individuals. I don't know why individuals, because firms also fell under those sanctions. But these harsher sanctions were applied to both liability side of the balance sheet, meaning that you cannot place new debts, and also the asset side, mm-hmm. meaning that if you have some foreign asset holdings and you fall under this category, you are given some short period of time to sell those assets. And clearly, when you need to sell something very fast, you encounter fire sale prices, meaning that you lose a lot. And this first bank, Bank Russia, it was quite large, entering top 30 banks in Russia in terms of size out of 1,000 banks operated back in the day. And this bank had to reduce its foreign assets by something like 20 percentage points of the total assets of this bank. It's quite a lot. It's about 0.4% of Russia's GDP. You just see immediately this abrupt, dramatic decline. It was really a shock. If all banks were sanctioned back in the day like this, then the effect could be much more severe. But then, next banks were sanctioned only 4 months after. And the largest bank with this, like Sberbank, which had more than 160 years of operations of back in imperial times, you know, before Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And it's disproportionately large, right? The bank is controlling 1/3 of the total banking system in Russia. This bank was sanctioned only in 12 September 2014. Effectively, this bank had 6 months to adapt. And what we saw from media reports that bank started increasing its placements of debts abroad. Over this period, the bank increased its placements of euro bonds. So these are denominated not in yuans or not this Eastern currency, no, euro bonds in euros or dollars in Western part of the world, increased by a factor of 2 times more than the same period 1 year ago. And the most puzzling part was that the coupon rate was the same 4.4% on average as it was 1 year ago before any sanctions, any interventions and annexation. Foreign investors from Europe, US and the stuff, they were ready to lend to Sberbank at the same rate as before. This is super puzzling. These guys, they couldn't have been unaware about what happened, but they were still ready to lend. Meaning that probably under uncertainty, you just don't know what will happen. Is it a long conflict or short conflict? You just know that it's the largest bank. It had fantastic history of operations, never delayed its repayments or never defaulted on its debt. So you just want to continue to lend. And from the Sberbank standpoint, it was like, okay, now sanctions, new geopolitical era. While we are not sanctions, we need to increase our cheap borrowings from abroad. They were indeed much cheaper than borrowing domestically. This staggered implementation, this like many sanction announcement, they produce this unintended effect of not yet sanctioned banks increasing their borrowings from abroad so that Russia effectively mm-hmm. was enjoying a greater inflow of cheaper funds from the Western part of the world despite the sanction regime has been already adopted.
Mikhail, how did these banks that were not yet sanctioned, how could they be sure that they were going to be sanctioned?
Months after months, March, April 2014, more and more firms were sanctioned. Mm-hmm. They all shared similar feature that they were either directly state-owned enterprises or controlled by oligarchs with close ties to Kremlin. These are like not those oligarchs who are like nomads and live in London. No, no. So these are oligarchs who are friends to the regime. So if you are a state-connected bank, you understand that, well, there are no signals of Crimea being returned to Ukraine, no signals mm-hmm. of sanctions being stopped. I'm a state-connected bank. Should I sit and do nothing? No, I have a fear of asset freezes by Western governments if I have foreign asset holdings in the Western part of the world. So I want to start selling them in advance. And I want to increase foreign borrowings because, well, the sanctions, they affect only new borrowings. So if I have existing debts, no. So I'm just perfectly allowed to continue using them.
And this meant that you have a set of banks that you know to look at to examine their behavior.
Yeah, so of course, we took an exposed perspective. We know mm-hmm. that in 5 years after 2014, 44 banks were sanctioned. 20 of them were directly owned by the government and 24 were controlled by these oligarchs with close ties to the Kremlin. We had monthly balance sheet data from those banks disclosed publicly back in the day by the Central Bank of Russia. Now this data is all closed. And we took an advantage of investigating what they were doing with their foreign borrowings and foreign assets months after months after months. And also depending on how close they are to the government in terms of people on board of those banks, whether they had some political connections, whether they were some mayors or governors of specific regions, whether they were also entering some board of directors of different non-financial state enterprises.
You see this action from all of these banks to mitigate the effect of sanctions before the sanctions are brought in on them. You've also looked at the real economy and the impact on firms. What did you find there?
In terms of lending to firms, and also, by the way, to households. So first of all, what we observe is that domestic depositors, they indeed started to panic once sanctions arrived against the banks where they had their savings. And they were withdrawing funds from those banks. Clearly, the government stepped in because back in the days, international assets of the Russian government, they were not frozen. So the government helped those banks to survive, to prevent their disorderly failures, meaning that on the liability side of those banks, nothing terrible happened. Actually, the government oversupported by injecting very cheap liquidity to those banks. And banks could support lending from the asset side. But what we observe is that banks also, they were not stupid. So we have two different layers of analysis. The first one, when we try to take the most granular analysis, we take syndicated loans when we know which bank lends to which firm. And what we see there is that immediately upon the first sanction announcement, not yet sanctioned banks like Sberbank, VTB, the second bank, Gazprom Bank, the third bank, they reduced the supply of loans to firms by 20%, even if those firms were private firms and had nothing to do with sanctions. But if those firms were state-connected firms, the reduction of credit supply was as large as 87%.
Wow.
Okay, it's a specific type of loans. It's not the whole universe of loans, but still, banks were strategic. They realized that if we lend to private firms, shrink by 20%, because who knows which types of problems the economy will encounter in the future because of those sanctions. But if these are state-connected firms, let the government help those firms. Then, when we go to the bank aggregated level, we see that this reduction of corporate lending by state-connected firms was huge. It was equivalent to 4% of Russia's GDP.
Gosh.
Quite a large effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's consistent what people find in the trade sanctions literature regarding Russia, that actually firms, they suffered. When trade sanctions were imposed, state-connected firms affected by those sanctions had to shrink employment by 25%, shrink investment by 30%. These are findings by Ann and Ludema, published 2020 in European Economic Review. So we are very much consistent with those findings, even though we are exploring financial sanctions, not trade sanctions. But then, very unintended effect is that the liability side of the balance sheet of those banks was supported by the government. Okay, they shrunk lending to corporates by 4% of GDP, but the new thing that we found is that they effectively redirected credit from corporates to households, and households witnessed a rise of credit supply by 4.1% of Russia's GDP.
So exactly the same. Yeah.
Yeah. So when policymakers in Europe and US discussed that overall sanctions had no effects on Russia, they actually had effect. Because this zero effect can be composed by huge minus for firms and unintended huge plus for households. The second ingredient is that the world is structured as it is, right? We have China, we have Turkey, we have India. They are sort of neutral. If you are the US government, you can easily sanction Russia because Russia's share in world GDP, what, 1.5%? But can you imagine US sanctioning China? No, no, it's like shooting in your own leg. So you have to close your eyes on the fact that some Russian firms and banks, they now borrow through intermediary firms and banks in China, in Turkey, and India. And those firms, they borrow from the West. So staggered implementation, evasion through neutral countries, and voila, we have what we have. Sanctions, they don't reach their goal, unfortunately.
These were called smart sanctions, but this staggered implementation does not appear to be particularly smart. Was this, with hindsight, a huge strategic error?
Yeah, exactly.
Now we have more sanctions, much tougher packages of sanctions. Can you make a comparison between what happened in 2014 and what happened in 2022?
Yes. So now we observe that effectively the great bulk of all Russian banks and firms are sanctioned, even if they are not state connected, even if they are large, because now there is a growing understanding from the policymaking perspective is that if you don't sanction private banks and firms, they can help sanction firms and banks to evade. Because, okay, you could have a partnership between Sberbank and some private bank, and you say, hey, private bank, can you borrow for me something?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? You are allowed to do so. But now, there is a growing understanding that you need to sanction everybody to prevent those evasion effects. But at the same time, as I've said, you cannot sanction China. So this is still there. And unfortunately, sanctions are evaded. And my personal dramatic experience or understanding is that sanctions are evaded not only through this eastern part of the world,
mm-hmm.
but there are lots and lots of examples how European firms, how they help evade sanctions. If they had established relationships with Gazprom or Sberbank or Rosneft, if they are still profitable, you are a firm sending equipment to Rosneft to extract oil, whatever. You sit together with Rosneft and say, look, I cannot directly send you this equipment, but let's open a branch in some other country. I'll be sending my equipment there and you'll buy it there. It works perfectly well, even with European firms. And the same European firms and banks might announce here in Europe that, yeah, we are slowing down our operations in Russia. Because it's very much important to publicly announce that. But when it comes to real business, money don't smell. We can discuss the sanction a lot, but the design must be changed.
Imagine that we could go back 10 years. Designing a package of sanctions in 2014 that, even given the problems that you've outlined, would have had a more important effect. What would that package of sanctions have looked like?
You cannot sanction China, Chinese banks and firms. But what you could do as a Western government, you can try to break the incentives of Chinese, Indian, Turkish banks, firms to support Russian banks and firms. Think about those incentives. Anything which can be more profitable for those firms and banks in these neutral countries to increase operations with the Western part of the world rather than with Russia. By the way, we don't have to speak only about Russia, because unfortunately these geopolitical tensions, they rise and rise, and I just expect that more and more countries will be sanctioned in the future. If we want sanctions to be an effective economic mechanism which can substitute for physical war, we need to think about incentives of neutral countries to support sanctioned countries. We need to provide them some contracts for finance trade so that that's going to be more profitable for them.
Well, let's hope we can learn from the past. But for now, Mikhail, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
The paper is called Crime and Punishment: How Banks Anticipate and Propagate Global Financial Sanctions. The authors are Mikhail Mamonov, Anna Pestova, and Stephen Onjina.
This has been a Vox Talk from the CEPR Paris Symposium 2024. Coming later this week, the painstaking research that reveals how effective the Ukraine war sanctions against Russia have been.